You are listening to the Punk News Podcast for the week of March 6, 2013. Woo! Party! Blowout 2013. Woo! We got sun, sand, and a party plan coming to you live on location from Sunny Beach in Kona, Florida. I don't know about you, but this looks like a dream to me. We've got babes in bikinis, studs and speedos, booze, food, and all that is rude, baby. As always, on the Punk News Podcast Spring Break Blowout 2013, we're going to be talking about all the hippest topics for you. We're going to be talking about Against Me dropping off the Bad Religion tour. We're going to be talking about Rancid releasing a brand new bootleg from 1995. We're going to be talking about the Stooges. We're going to give you a reading assignment. We're going to be talking about Randy Blythe finally getting out of jail. We're going to be talking about Bowie finally releasing a brand new album. And we're going to be talking about everybody's favorite Bay Area punk rocker, Billy Joe. He's feeling groovy these days, and he had a big spread in the Rolling Stone magazine. And of course, no party would be complete without a party jam. We've got our house DJ, Sound Guy Nairman, spinning the fiercest cuts that will get you out of the hotel room and down here on the hot sandy beach in Daytona Beach, Florida. We've got newest, hottest jams from all the bands that the hip teens are into these days. We've got jams from Congenital Death and The Garden. And helping me get this party started on the Punk News Podcast Spring Break Blowout 2013 is the man who puts low in suntan lotion, the man who thinks G-string bikinis cover too much, reviews editor Brian Yancey. Brian, how are you enjoying Spring Break Blowout 2013?
I'm enjoying it immensely now that I know what's happening.
And of course, also with us, with a coconut rum drink in each hand, is the man, the kid who is tearing up the charts with his newest hot summer jam, Baby, 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 I Love You, Baby, the guy who doesn't go anywhere unless he's in a limo, including the bathroom, managing editor, Adam White. Adam, how are you enjoying down here with all the beautiful girls, all the good-looking guys, and all the beautiful weather down here in sunny Daytona Beach, Florida?
You know, I am recording in a bathroom, so that's not really that far off from reality.
Well, when you're number one on the charts, you can do what you want, including recording from the bathroom. And also, I've heard a rumor, an unsubstantiated rumor, that maybe, just maybe, LL Cool J will be dropping by on the Punk News Podcast Spring Break Blowout 2013 here in sunny Daytona Beach, Florida. So we'll have to see if LL Cool J does or does not drop on by. And of course, the man spinning the wax, the man who never lacks, the man who is in a constant state of relax, DJ Sound Guy Nairman. Nairman, hit us with a beat. And so without further ado, let's get this podcast Spring Break Blowout 2013 started. First thing we're going to talk about is Against Me. As a lot of people know, is it Max Weinberg who just left Against Me?
Or is Jay Weinberg, not Max.
Recently left Against Me, and it seemed as though he was fired from the band and he didn't choose to leave, although I think it's still a little unclear. Against Me was scheduled to tour with Bad Religion and Polar Bear Club for a fairly extensive tour that I think lasted about 2 months or so. However, they decided that they're not going to tour, and here's the reason they gave why. Unfortunately, we have to cancel all of our appearances scheduled for the upcoming tour with Bad Religion and Polar Bear Club. Canceling a tour is definitely not a decision we would make lightly. At this moment, due to our current uncertainty over who is going to be playing drums with us, we feel like we are lacking the ability to put on the show our fans deserve, and we think that the best thing for us to do right now is to take some time to regroup and finish a record. So what do you guys think? Should have they powered on through and just brought in a hired gun? Did it was the right decision? Are they covering other maybe problems that they're having and just saying it's a drummer issue?
I don't know. It's unclear at this point still. I mean, this topic sort of came up before when they had Adam Willard fill in for them on their Australian tour. Now, I think that the fact that this was an American tour, not an Australian tour, has a lot to do with them canceling. If the tour was overseas somewhere, they might have been able to find a replacement. And I think they would have powered through it in that case just because of the logistics involved, maybe the extra money involved, who knows. It seems like that the band, you know, because of all the different things that have surrounded them for, you know, the last year or so, or, you know, they want to finish this record. They're having a difficult time finishing this record. Obviously, it's the most important record of their career thus far. So the fact that they want to take more time and make sure that it's right and everything else, and you know, that's fine. I mean, it's a bummer for their fans who wanted to see them live on this tour, and obviously it would have been a really good tour for them to be on. But you know, they have to do what's best for them, and if they don't feel they're ready to put on a great show, especially if they don't have a drummer in place either permanently or temporarily, then you know, it makes sense.
But I really thought that Adam Willard was going to keep playing for them for a little while. I didn't realize that was just a one-off thing for Australia. There's something that we did not know here, because this tour was slated to start in like 8 days. So clearly when they signed on to it, someone was under the impression that they were going to have a full roster. So I wonder who dropped or who, you know, like it seems like almost that their drummer must have fallen out very recently, because why would they have, you know, why would they have got to this point and then canceled? Like, people bought tickets for this shit. Like, this is, you know, you know, there are people that are going to show up at that door looking to see Against Me at this point. So, yeah, that, I mean, on the one hand, like, you know, it kind of sucks for like Bad Religion and them, because, you know, Against Me is a big name act and they're a draw. So how do you, who do you go and replace them with in 8 days?
Yeah, that's the tough part.
You know, I mean, like Polar Bear Club is fun live and everything, but they're not like Against Me. They're not going to be able to carry that whole show with like Polar Bear Club and some, you know, local opener. Like, they're going to need to fill that slot, and finding a band to just jump in and do that is going to be tough. So, you know, like there's financial implications to all of a sudden canceling a tour at this point. And you got to imagine that there's going to be some people that were probably going to that show for Against Me, and they're going to want refunds and everything else, and just makes a mess for the promoters and the venues and everyone involved. So,
yeah,
you know, that's no fun. Where is Mikey Erg? I mean, I know we all joke about it, but we all joke about it because it just makes sense. Mikey Erg should be drumming for Against Me.
And, yeah, why not?
Yeah, I mean, he drums for everyone. He's, you know, clearly kind of from the same, I don't know, spiritual wheelhouse as Against Me would be, I guess. I don't even know what that means. But, you know, he should be there. It makes sense. Where's Mike Yurek? I put the blame squarely on him.
Yeah, I'm actually going to, like, record a really crappy singer-songwriter album with just me and acoustic guitar called Spiritual Wheelhouse. I think it'll be, like, deep, you know. But as for Mike Yurek, he really is the go-to guy for this. I mean, Mikey Erg was in the Ergs, who weren't quite as big as Against Me, and he was in a lot of other bands that were, like, not nearly as popular as that. But he did drum, and he was on the album for Star Effing Hipsters, which is probably about as big as Against Me, or maybe a little bit, like, less popular. But, I mean, I'm saying if you can hang with SZA Crack and all those guys, then you can hang with any band there is, you know? So I think that it's really not an issue with the drummer. I don't want to say they're using the drummer as a scapegoat, but I think they're, and I have absolutely no inside information. I don't know at all, and this is purely just me hypothesizing. But I think that they're having other issues. Either they're not getting along, or and I'm sure right now, like, tensions and difficulties and understandings are high within the band, because I'm sure right now Laura Jane Grace has a lot of things that she has to work through, which, you know, anytime anybody has something they have to work through, it can make things either less comfortable or more comfortable with people that you hang around. So who knows? But I think there's something going on within the band that is not necessarily related to the drummer issue, particularly because Adam Willard could drum, or, you know, if his schedule doesn't, you know, fit up with the Against Me schedule right now, you could get Mikey Erg, who always seems to have a wide open schedule, and even on Facebook, he even says sometimes on Facebook, if you need me to drum on your tour, I'm available this month, you know, or have one of the guys from Bomb the Music Industry. I mean, there's so many other bands that, I mean, it's not, I mean, Against Me's got interesting drumming, but Against Me isn't like Dream Theater. Like, you know, you could pick up the drums for that band in about a week or less, I'm thinking.
So. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a couple of things. I think one, it could be them not wanting to rush, you know, a drummer into this, for one. For the second thing, I think it's just tough. And in terms of timing, I only have a very small knowledge of how large-scale tours are booked, but I know that oftentimes they are booked several months in advance, and that when this tour was booked, long before it was announced to the public, it could have been like last summer that this tour was booked. You know what I mean? So obviously back then when the tour was booked, Against Me probably had a full lineup. They don't now. So it could just be one of those things where, you know, it sucks. They kind of waited until maybe they waited until the last minute to cancel, you know, because of whatever reason. But, you know, that could be something else at play here.
Query, when a band has the issue of do we not tour at all or do we tour with a replacement drummer and we might not be as good, should they go on tour?
I mean, I think every situation is different. It just depends on the band, it depends on the music, it depends on what kind of opportunity the tour presents. A lot of bands, because they see an opportunity that they might not get again, will quickly find a replacement drummer and go on that tour, maybe not play as well as they could. On the other hand, you know, more established bands like Against Me, for example, can, you know, it's as much of a blow it is, it's something that they can get through because they're more established and they will get other tours. They're, you know, people aren't going to stop offering them tours because they canceled this one. You know what I mean? So it just depends, I think.
You know, not knowing what it actually takes to, you know, perform live music, because I that's just not within my spiritual wheelhouse. I've got to imagine that, like, if your drummer's not, you know, on point, it's probably pretty tough to hold things together. Like you know, especially in a band that has, you know, that's going to have like as much material to go through as Against Me would in a set where, you know, the rest of the band is going to kind of be on point. That, why did I say on point twice? I'm reading like too many Dad Boner tweets or something. that, you know, if you don't have that anchor, I could entirely see it being really frustrating to, you know,
yeah,
to play. So, you know, I don't want to under something what the drummer somethings in a band or something.
Well, I'm going to answer my own question. And the question was, should a band power through even if they're not at 100%? And my answer is yes, they always should in every situation. Because basically, if they just say, you know what, we lost our drummer or whatever, but we still want to come visit, we still want to play the gig, and we're just going to be raw, rough, and rugged, you know, and maybe do a slightly shorter set, you know, more energetic, so it's more raw, that's what they should do. And I think fans appreciate that more, a band saying, we're going the extra mile for you guys, even though we've had a few setbacks, rather than, you know, oh, we're like Morrissey, everything has to be exactly 100% perfect. But I mean, I you know, that's kind of a broad rule. Everyone has their own circumstances.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, but I feel like there are bands out there, and I think Against Me would fall under this category, that are, you know, very protective of their dynamic, if you will. And if they can't portray that live, you know, as well as they want to, as well as they possibly can, that's something that's up to their high standard, then they're probably not going to do it. But I understand what you're saying, and I mostly agree with it.
Well, fair enough. Speaking of live shows, believe it or not, out of the blue, more or less, Rancid have just released a free download of a 1995 show that the band played in London. They say it's their first in a series of bootlegs that they'll be giving away for free. I listened to the set. It's pretty fresh. Most of the songs are within their spiritual wheelhouse. I just don't know. What do you guys think of bands like giving away bootlegs for free? Is this the way how bands can maintain interest? Is Rancid just trying to keep fans active in the Rancid, I guess, spiritual wheelhouse while they're working on another album? And what do you think of the tattoos of Baby Rancid here, where they have basically no spiderweb skull tattoos and no face tattoos or forehead tattoos?
Oh, those were the halcyon days, weren't they? Just everything was different. Everything was so innocent. And you know, I got like, now this may have been like the crappy laptop speakers that I was doing my podcast research on, but this really didn't sound all that good to me. Maybe it's better when you're actually listening to it properly, but you know, it's cool if they're releasing it. You know, I don't know if it's something that someone's actually going to want to sit through. You know, this was a good time for Rancid for sure. It was, you know, what was 95? 95 was right when Out Come the Wolves came out, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was Rancid at their height for a lot of people. So cool that they're releasing this. I remember one of you guys were saying, and maybe it was you, John, was is it really a bootleg if they're releasing it themselves? And that's a valid point. But I mean, didn't Fugazi? I mean, I don't know why I'm comparing Rancid to Fugazi, but didn't Fugazi do something like this where they released just like reams of live material that they had recorded?
Yes, right. Yeah. Now, oh, go ahead, Yance.
I was just going to say, to answer Adam's question, yeah, Fugazi more or less recorded every live show they ever played and are, I think, still in the process of archiving all of them and releasing all of them. I'm not sure that's a complete project yet. Obviously, it's a huge project, so maybe it's not finished, but I haven't checked.
You see, I think that's pretty cool. I mean, we have the internet now. We have infinite storage and the ability to, you know, to share a lot more music. This is stuff that would probably never make sense to be pressed to vinyl or whatever else. No. So it's a way to get it out there so that people can check it out if they're into it. It's a way for a band to take like this, all this content that they've generated over the years and do something with it, which is awesome. If they were doing something a little bit more cynical, like, oh, we're going to print, 15 different colored vinyl variations of each of our sets and put that out for people to buy on eBay. Yeah, all right. That might be a little bit...
And each one comes with a baseball bat.
Each one comes with a little baseball bat, yeah. Little baseball bat, as we learned in the past podcast. Not a real full-size baseball bat, which is super disappointing.
Yes.
Cool. Put this stuff out. It probably isn't going to make a lot of waves outside of the band's fan base, but, a band like Rancid's got a fan base, so, feed them.
Yeah. I agree. It's cool of them to do. I didn't listen to it. I don't really feel the need to listen to it necessarily, just because when it comes to bootlegs, they don't really interest me very much. And unless like they're like a legendary performance that has gone in the books as one of the band's best shows ever, or if it's a show that I was at, like those are the two reasons I might check out some sort of bootleg. But other than that, it doesn't really interest me.
I gotta say, one thing I'll point out is it really bugs me when bands call things authorized bootlegs. What a bootleg is an unauthorized sound recording. So an authorized bootleg is an authorized, unauthorized sound recording, which drives me nuts. It could be a bootleg, but once a band officially releases it, it's no longer a bootleg, it's just a release. But I understand they call it a bootleg to say the sound quality's not that great. I guess kind of unlike you two guys, I'm a bootleg maniac, and bootlegs are technically copyright infringement. But man, I love bootlegs. The Rolling Stones are my favorite band. I probably have over 200 Rolling Stones bootlegs. And I've got ones that are, like really unique shows and ones that just kind of run in the mill. And it's kind of fun just to be able to grab one and basically be at a live concert and that you don't know what's going to be on the record or on the CD, rather. So that's a lot of fun for me. And I love bootlegs because you can hear special concerts like sometimes of groups that like do weird things. For example, Rancid actually did release like 100 soundboard recordings about 8 years ago, and they were selling them for $10 each, and I loved it. They actually had one where they did the two Operation Ivy covers, which was really cool. And I don't know if it's financially feasible or profitable for bands to do this, but I really hope more and more bands release live recordings for like maybe $5 a download or something, because I love them. I love live albums, and I love it when you can get like a lot of them. So I gotta say, thumbs up for Rancid for doing this. I think they're probably doing it to keep people interested in Rancid while they're putting out their next record. But whatever. I mean, frankly, I don't care about the motivation if the music's good. So I'm excited for this model, and I hope more bands take suit. So,
word up.
I guess following on, where we talked about the Stooges, I guess 2 weeks ago, but we're going to talk about them again because the Stooges have recently released the very first full-length track from Iggy Pop and Iggy and the Stooges since 1973 Raw Power. They did release The Weirdness about 6 years ago, but that was technically the Stooges. Now Iggy and the Stooges features James Williamson, who was on Raw Power, but not the first two Stooges albums. So you guys check out the jam. What did you think? I will say that one person said at any time at Punk News, here's what he said. He said, effing awesome. The comments on the track, the SoundCloud track, not that cool. And then somebody else, Party Animal, he said, oof. So it's getting what you call mixed reception, if you will.
You could say that. you could say that. If you go in with low expectations, I guess it's fine. I would say it sounds like... it sounds like a 65-year-old man trying to play a punk song. So, which is what it is. And I mean, it's kind of slow and it's kind of plodding and the lyrics don't make any sense. And, you know, the lyrics aren't really that good to begin with. So I don't know. To me, this isn't a good first taste of this record. It doesn't really whet my appetite to hear anything else from it. But who knows? Maybe this is just a poor choice for a first single, if you will, and maybe there'll be some other good jams on it.
Is there a distinction between Iggy and the Stooges and the Stooges?
Yes, there's a very specific distinction between Iggy and the Stooges and the Stooges. The Stooges are Iggy Pop, James Williamson. I mean, I screwed it up already. The Stooges are Iggy Pop and the I can't believe I forgot the two brothers. Iggy Pop. Well, let me look it up real quick. Adam, you talk, and I'll tell you the distinction in a second.
Ashton brother.
Ron Ashton and Scott Ashton.
Right.
Ron Ashton on guitar and Scott Ashton on drums. Am I right about that? I hope so. I should know this. I feel bad about not knowing this. The point is, the first two Stooges albums are that lineup. Scott Ashton on drums. Is that what I said?
Yeah.
Yeah, Scott Ashton on drums. That's the Stooges lineup. The Stooges broke up after their second album, which is called Funhouse. After they broke up, David Bowie called up Iggy Pop and says, "We should do a record or something." And so Iggy Pop says, "Yeah, but I'll only do it if I can do it with the Stooges." Somehow, likely either the label or David Bowie says, "Well, you got to bring in James Williamson, who was a guitar player." So the Stooges are just Iggy and the two Ashton brothers. Iggy and the Stooges, which is the title of the third Stooges record, Raw Power, is Iggy, James Williamson on lead guitar, Ron Ashton on bass, I believe, and then Scott Ashton on drums. So he got kind of demoted, if you will, which is kind of a surprise. And that's the distinction. Now, Iggy and the Stooges, though, is kind of an amalgamation of everything. It's Iggy Pop on vocals, James Williamson on guitar, Steve McKay on sax, Mike Watt on bass, and Scott Williamson on drums. FYI.
Okay, right. So but here's where I'm going at here. So when the Stooges, just the Stooges, released The Weirdness a few years ago, Mike Watt played on that as well.
Yes.
So, and Mike Watt is also playing on this new Iggy and the Stooges record?
Yes, yeah, so technically Mike Watt is the only guy to be in both. Never mind, that's not true.
So, I'm just saying that the distinction between the Stooges and Iggy and the Stooges is incredibly fuzzy to me and is not one that I had mentally made myself. But
well,
anyways.
Well, actually, I'm going to interrupt you. Like, the Stooges, I mean, you could disagree with this, and I won't disagree with that. But among Stooges maniacs, the idea is it Ron Ashton on guitar or James Williamson? Because they have very different styles. So that's the difference between the Stooges and Iggy and the Stooges.
Oh, my head hurts. Okay, anyways. You know what? This is sort of a boring song. I was super amused reading the comments on the SoundCloud thing, which has always struck me as a really, really weird internet... I don't know, feedback idiom that they had come up with where you just, as the song is playing, it's just reading you these little quippy things from people that have left comments. And because you only have like a few characters to leave a comment, they're shorter than tweets. It's usually just people like, "Woo, Stooges." So, like, I don't know if I need to see that under each, every couple seconds. It's super hypnotic for some reason. I was going to turn the song off because I was like, this is boring me, but I'm like, but I'm hypnotized by the weird little SoundCloud comments, so that's a thing. I think it's kind of funny how as Iggy has aged, he sounds more and more like sort of a weird Jim Morrison.
Yeah.
True.
Which I'm not making a quality comment on. It's just an observation. But yeah, I can't imagine that this is going to be too out of step with, you know, with the Weirdness or, you know, with, I guess I want to talk about Skull Ring or anything like that. Like, it's going to be one of these latter day Iggy projects that's going to appeal to a lot of people on nostalgic notes. It's not really going to make waves outside of anyone that would not already be inclined to listen to later day Stooges stuff. And
you know, it's a footnote in a career that, you know, had its big moments a long time ago. And I hate to say that sounding disparaging of like the godfather of punk and everything, but you know, I just don't think anyone's really going to care.
Yeah, here's what the reviews are going to be. People are going to be like, they redeem themselves from the weirdness, but it's not as good as the first three records, so it's an otherwise forgettable entry into the Stooges catalog. That's what the reviews are going to be. I heard the Jam. It's not terrible, but it's not great. Sometimes people have said, well, was Iggy ever a great lyricist ever? And I got to say, he was. If you ask me on those first three Stooges records, like, his lyrics are great, especially on Funhouse with like TVI and 1970. I think his concept of, like, I guess, wild, self-destructive despair predates Joy Division, predates Sex Pistols, and it's just so clever. And I think it's kind of new for rock music as a whole. I guess he was influenced by blues singers who would kind of do that, guys like Howlin' Wolf, guys like Leadbelly, guys like Lightning Hopkins would have, like, these really self-destructive, powerful lyrics. And I think that's where Iggy got it from. At least I think he's kind of said that before. But I think it was new to rock music that, like, I'm a wild guy, I'm not to self-destruct, and I'm not sure if I care or not. So I would say Iggy was a fantastic lyricist back in the day. But since then, he's put out a lot of whack albums with a lot of whack lyrics. So really, for this to be really good, he's got to shine. So we'll see. I'm, as the AV Club says, cautiously optimistic. Adam, I think we're going to issue a homework assignment, possibly. You were mentioning an interesting article on the on the internets, if you will, that we're going to read over this next week and maybe talk about next week. And so if the kids listening out there and adults listening out there and all the partiers here at the Punk News Summer Blowout 2013 want to read, they can read it and we'll talk about it next week.
Yeah, all right. So I guess I can take some credit for exposing this to the Punk News audience and therefore causing shit, which is kind of fun. A Seattle musician named John Roderick wrote a article that was the lead article in the weekly, the Seattle Weekly paper, which is like one of the, I assume one of like the alt paper things that exists in the Seattle area, called Punk Rock is Bullshit. And in it, he goes through this argument that he's kind of worked out with himself about how punk rock, more the punk rock ethos, less the punk rock music, although the line is kind of fuzzy at times, is bullshit and is responsible for, and I'm going to horribly paraphrase this, creating this sense of cynical irony that exists in a lot of the music world these days, where people are so afraid of success or afraid of enjoying something without having to justify whether they're, you know, maintaining their punk rock credibility or anything like that. So it's an interesting article. I mean, I want to put a little bit of context around this. So Roderick is he's the singer, lead songwriter, guitarist for a band that was on Barsook Records called The Long Winters. And he's played on a bunch of records for various bands from that kind of Seattle scene. So he was on Death Cab's Transatlanticism. He's played with on records from like Not a Surf and the Decemberists. He was a touring member of Harvey Danger. He plays with Jonathan Colton live a lot right now. I know about him because he has he's one half of a podcast called Roderick on the Line, which is absolutely brilliant, and that's actually how I kind of came into this. That Roderick on the Line is an amazing podcast. It makes our thing sound like shit, let me tell you. Where he's kind of taken up this like weird, you know, elder statesman cultural commentator grump persona, where he just has these just incredible, weird, often very deep, often very hilarious insights on whatever. And him and Merlin Mann, who is I want to say like internet celebrity. Merlin Mann is was known for writing like a bunch of books on productivity, or not a book, a bunch of blogs and stuff that were really big in like the internet productivity life hacks realm a few years ago. I think 43 Folders was the one big one that he read, that he wrote. And he's since become like a well-known personality on a lot of the big podcast networks around there. There's a big podcast network called 5x5 that has a bunch of shows. like Back to Work that he co-hosts. So anyways, what Roderick on the Line is it's basically Merlin Mann and John Roderick having a conversation about whatever. They call each other up on Skype and have a conversation. It comes out like once a week. It's a great show. Anyways, about a month ago on Roderick on the Line, he exposited this punk rock is bullshit theory. And I remember when I was listening to it, and I felt incredibly challenged from it, but he wasn't entirely wrong at times. But the article itself is very much in that same vein, except probably a little bit more thought out because it's written and not spoken. And I don't think it's the kind of thing that I really want our readers or anything like that to pass some sort of finalistic judgment on. Like, I don't need like Roderick's an idiot or, you know, or yeah, he's right or anything like that, because I don't think that's what it's about. It's more that like, it's kind of cool to have someone come in and challenge you on your shit, especially when your shit has so much ideology and stuff wrapped up in it as punk rock does. So I think that it sort of behooves you to read this thing, because even if you don't agree with it, you know, you should come out the other end a little bit more convinced about what actually, you know, why you like this bullshit form of music that we're all wrapped up in. So I think it's an incredibly provocative piece. And we posted on the Punk News Twitter account tonight, and everyone's kind of raging around with it. Like, Jeff Rosenstock was like confronting John Roderick on Twitter and everything. So, you know, it's getting under a lot of people's skin, which in my mind is actually pretty punk rock. So I don't know. Yeah. There you go. Give this thing a read. It's interesting. And I guess we'll talk about it next week, because, you know, I myself even haven't had time to read the whole thing. It just kind of popped up today online. So, yeah, if you go to the Seattle Weekly, you'll find it there. Or if you, like, look at the Punk News Twitter archive or whatever, it'll be there. Or, yeah, but go read it. That's your homework, podcast listeners. Punk Rock is Bullshit by John Roderick in the Seattle Weekly.
Woo! Punk Rock! Yeah. Punk Rock! Punk News Podcast Spring Break Blowout 2013. I think it's time for some jams. Brian Yancey, I think you got a jam to keep this limbo party going.
Oh, do I ever. Although I don't recommend trying to limbo to this song. So I've got a song from a band from Philly. Big surprise. They're called Congenital Death. And they play a brand of, I guess you could call it, power violence. It's pretty intense stuff. It's very hard. It's very fast. It is very loud. But at the same time, where I feel a lot of those bands in that genre get tied up in, sounding as mean as possible, you know, they kind of lose the feeling, the personality that should be inherent in any good music. A lot of that music kind of seems like it's kind of like just existing off into the ether. It's kind of distant sounding. It doesn't necessarily... Nobody can necessarily relate to it. It's just noise, basically. That's not the case here. So this band, this is the opening track from their recent EP, From My Hands. They're going to be opening for Paint It Black at Paint It Black's record release show at the First Unitarian Church on the 31st of March, along with Joyce Manor and one other band that I can't think of right now. But definitely check that out. This whole EP is up for Name Your Price download on their Bandcamp, which is congenitaldeath.bandcamp.com. This is the first song from it. It's pretty rad, and it's called Mona's Therapy. We'll be right back.
while we were playing that Congenital Death track, who would you believe, but LL Cool J showed up and he talked to us. Man, what did you guys think of LL? He was pretty cool, wasn't he?
He was fine.
I didn't get a chance
to ask him about the hat. Well, he was just wearing a hat everywhere.
Yeah, man, I gotta say, I mean, you know, LL, he's done a lot of R&B tracks, but back in the day, you know, Radio, I'm Gonna Knock You Out. Man, he's still a legend. I know a lot of people weren't that impressed with him because they, you know, they're more in the deathcore, grindcore here at, you know, Punk News, Spring Break Blowout 2013. But I gotta say, you gotta have respect for the hip hop founders, even though, you know, grindcore and thrashcore is more, I guess, more marketable these days. You know, it's more on the radio. Speaking of more marketability, quite surprising to me at least is Randy Blythe, who is the vocalist of Lamb of God, about a year ago, I guess now, was arrested for manslaughter from a 2010 incident all the way over in the Czech Republic. When he came back to the country about a year ago, he was arrested for manslaughter because somebody died. It was really unclear about how the person died. Literally just to yesterday, believe it or not, he was found not guilty of manslaughter and released back to America. Here's what he said. He said, "I have been found not guilty and acquitted of all charges against me. I am a free man. Please remember the family of Daniel Nosek, who is the guy that died, in your thoughts and prayers in this difficult time. I only wish for them peace. Thank you for your support, Randy." It should be pointed out that Randy Blythe made, I don't want to say a big to-do, but he was pretty, I guess, noble or honorable in saying, "I'm not going to hide in America. I'm going to go back to the Czech Republic to stand trial for this manslaughter," which I say was pretty ballsy, because who knows what could go down in the Czech Republic. He could have got 5 years in a Czech jail, which certainly isn't, you know, as much of a party as it is here on the Punk News Podcast, Spring Break Blowout, in warm, sunny beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. What do you guys think of this? I'm surprised.
I mean, it's surprising. I mean, I don't know... We don't know the details of the acquittal. Google Translate is wonky, and this Czech site, obviously, I don't know Czech, and I can't read Czech, and I can't speak Czech, so I don't know. Yeah, I mean, we always hear these horror stories, you know, whether they're real or whether they're, you know, overinflated or whatever it is, of, you know, Americans abroad having legal troubles, and then the legal systems in those countries not being quite as upstanding or as impartial as they should be necessarily, especially toward Americans. It's cool, you know. I mean, it's still sad that the guy died. Based on all of the info that we've had over this concerning this case for the last year or so, I think it's probably the right call. I mean, I'm sure, obviously, Mr. Blythe didn't kill this man on purpose, or maybe not even by accident, obviously. So, yeah, I mean, it's a weird story that looks like it's going to have a happy ending.
I'm not going to go so far as that. State prosecutors are saying that they want to appeal the verdict. The relatives of the fan who are seeking compensation for the fan's death were told by the court that they should go file a separate case. So he was acquitted of what was the actual thing? Involuntary manslaughter or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. So he was acquitted of that, but there's going to be an appeal, which he's going to have to deal with. Now, I'm not the lawyerly type, so I don't exactly know, how much shit that means he might still be in, but there's also, looks like there's going to be a separate case for compensation that the relatives are going to file. So, you know, I doubt he's completely out of the woods on this.
First of all, I got to say much props to Randy Blythe, because little while back he posted a short essay or a piece saying that he had a child die of his own when the child was very young. So he didn't want to not show up and like insult the family and, you know, just say, "Oh, your son's dead, but I don't care." He basically said he was going to show up and show that it wasn't his fault that the young man died, which is exactly what he did, which has a lot of guts. So I got to say, Randy Blythe, he was a, quote, real man, if you will, on this one. With regards to the civil case, what happens is the court said, well, you can file a civil suit against me if you want. Generally speaking, most modernized countries have what's called criminal court and civil court. I think Canada is the same as the U.S. You know, in criminal court, you can go to jail or whatever, but civil court is basically you can just get monetary compensation from someone else, generally speaking. You can also get other types of compensation, but that's just generally speaking. So let's say they sue him personally in the Czech Republic. Well, who cares? Because all he has to do is never go back to the Czech Republic, and they can't touch his funds because the Czech jurisdiction is only in the Czech Republic. So let's say they sue him and he doesn't answer and they get $100 million against him. What are they going to do to him? It's not like he's got any bank accounts in the Czech Republic. He could hire an attorney to fight back, which he would probably win because he won the criminal case, so I would guess he'd win the civil case too. But, I mean, what's that going to cost him? $10,000, $20,000, $40,000, $100,000? That's a lot of wasted money, you know?
Yeah.
So anyways, I don't want to say he beat the rap, but he beat the rap mainly because there was no evidence ever actually issued that he ever touched the young man at all. There was evidence of a young man trying to climb the barricade and getting pushed back by bouncers, but there's no like pictures or video of Randy Blythe ever touching the kid, and no one ever said that he did touch the kid. They're just saying he's at fault, and they never said why. So I'm glad that this is a positive result for Randy Blythe. That's how I'll put it. I guess speaking of another positive result, if you will, David Bowie, after about, I think, 9 years or 10 years, has released a brand new album called The Next Day. The cover's, I think the cover's clever. It's literally just like a photoshopped image of the Heroes album with the word Heroes scratched out and like a place image here thing placed on top of Bowie's face. The album's been put up for streaming online for iTunes. It's getting very positive critical reaction. What are you guys thinking of this new album by Bowie?
I've only gone on the two songs so far that have been posted, so I need to dig into the whole thing here before I can really get a feel for it, I guess. So I'm really not qualified to say anything about this. There you go, professionalism on the Punk News Podcast for you. I don't know. I mean, when we discussed this on past shows, we talked about kind of how much time had passed, you know, between this and the prior one. Have you heard the whole thing, John?
Yeah, I have. It's very much a what I would call a Pitchfork album, and I don't mean to insult them, but what I'm saying is it's a very, I don't want to say sedate, but it's a very measured album.
And yeah, there are no
real bangers on it. It's the album can be, I guess, savored, if you will, but there's nothing that's going to blow you out the window.
So you see, yeah, because that's okay. That's along the lines of what I was kind of getting from it, was that I was listening to, what is it, The Stars Are Out Tonight, and for some reason, which kept sticking into my head, was The Cure's self-titled record that they released not too long ago. That was sort of in that same vein, like the band had been away for a while, you know, they'd of course been, you know, they had, you know, a good, oh shit, where am I going with this? You know, they had been considered, you know, one of the influencers of, you know, the Pitchfork crowd, and they release a record that doesn't really have anything that is a super standout on it, but is, I don't know, like sonically dense enough that it's a little bit catered to that, to you know, the indie art rock audience. So I don't know. I was getting that vibe, but that might be completely off base because actually. Have I just derailed this? I feel like I have.
No, it's, yeah.
I'm just babbling.
It's totally fine. Yeah. I agree with what John had to say. I think the album is, I think measured is a good word to describe it in terms of how it sounds. It doesn't really take any risks necessarily, which is kind of what David Bowie's been known for throughout his career. On the other hand, it sounds very good. He sounds very good as a vocalist. So it's enjoyable. It's kind of a good thing to kind of have on in the background, not really have to pay too much attention to. So I like it for that. It's not really something that I'm going to, you know, revisit a whole bunch, but you know, I listened to the stream a couple of times. I enjoyed it. What do you think, John?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Like I said, it didn't blow me out of my seat, but it's kind of a mix between his Berlin period and his glam rock period, I guess, which is a good mix, I guess. Station to Station is my favorite Bowie album by far, and I think it's one of the greatest albums ever. But I like all his Berlin period. I think it's cool that Bowie kind of is one of the few guys that hasn't really jumped the shark, if you will. Like all his albums are not, they're not all good, but they're always David Bowie, and David Bowie being David Bowie. And I don't mean doing the same thing, but I mean doing interesting things that you think David Bowie would do. Honestly, though, I think this album's getting good reviews, but it's going to fade away, kind of like his album Heathen did, which is a good album, too. Everyone's like, oh, this is great, and it is a good album. But it's, I mean, simply because David Bowie's kind of done what David Bowie's already done, and he doesn't do anything wildly new on this, it's not going to reinvent music. People are going to say, oh, this is a fitting album for David Bowie to put out. So I guess, hey, good for David Bowie. It's a good album. It's not great. But, you know, I mean, in some ways, that's not bad. You know, a good David Bowie is better than no David Bowie, if you ask me. You know. So.
Sure, sure.
Speaking of good as opposed to no, Billy Joe Armstrong of Green Day, who just released three albums this past year that got mixed critical reviews, if you will, after his, I guess, breakdown on a Las Vegas festival where he said, who do you think I am? I'm not Justin Bieber. He apparently went to, what do you call it when you go to get drugs out of you? Rehab. And he's out
of the bathroom.
The bathroom. And Rolling Stone put him on the cover, which I found interesting because I didn't expect Rolling Stone to put Billy Joe on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine at this point. Here's what he said. I couldn't predict where I was going to end up at the end of the night. I'd wake up in a strange house on a couch. I wouldn't remember how. It was a complete blackout. I only remember the tiny things from the Vegas incident and the next morning. I woke up. I asked my wife, Adrian, how bad was it? She said, it's bad. I called my manager. He said, you're going to get on a plane, going back to Oakland, and get into rehab immediately. So, I mean, people can read the Rolling Stone feature. I think it's a pretty good feature. But more importantly, are we at the end of Green Day, or is this just a setup for Green Day's huge comeback?
I don't want to speak ill of him if he's having actual problems or anything like that, but there's something about this that just feels so...
too dramatic?
Like,
manufactured?
I don't want to doubt that he really had a problem, but that just the way that it has been framed that, oh, he had a meltdown. It's like, what was a meltdown? He had like a pissy little, you know, blow up on stage where he talked about Justin Bieber for a while and then fucked up a show that they had. You know, he didn't steal a backhoe and, you know, go on a... I don't know. It's just... There's something about it that just seems like... You know, not to say that his problems aren't real or anything like that, but that the controversy surrounding this quote-unquote blow-up has not been worth the press that it's created.
Yes.
You know, like, it's... So, like, I'm just thinking, like, oh, God, so you're right. So you have problems? Fine. Go to rehab and get your shit sorted out, especially since you have kids, and it's pretty fucking irresponsible if you're going to be, you know... I don't care if you're in a rock band, like, God. And then I'm just, you know, it doesn't need the cover of Rolling Stone or something like that. It's not like Billy Joe went on like some sort of incredible coke binge and kidnapped the president or something, right? He was on stage and he started bitching about Justin Bieber during like a big shitty radio concert that he was playing. Like, it's not. You know, we're not going to look back at like the great controversies of rock history and we're going to go, oh, you know, this is Green Day's Altamont right here. Like, no, this is just stupid. Like, go get the help you need and shut up.
Yeah, I agree. I don't have anything else to add. I think it's, you know, obviously it's great that he has gotten help, presumably. And, you know, has kind of defeated this this problem that he had, but I don't know. Like, it does feel a little overblown, and maybe overblown is the wrong word, but I'm sure the problem itself wasn't overblown. But the kind of response out in public that is, you know, happened in its wake, I feel is, I don't know. It's a little strange. It kind of leaves a weird taste in my mouth. You know, because. It just seems to happen like this so easily, you know. Famous musician, something happens, it's caught on tape. He's doing something or she's doing something, whoever it is, and it's caught. It goes viral on YouTube. It becomes a bigger deal than it ever would be if YouTube weren't a thing. And then, you know, a few months later, he gets out and he's on the cover of a magazine. And
yeah, that's, like, It's less some rock and roll controversy, and it is more celebrity gossip.
Yes.
And I guess that's what kind of bugs me about it.
Yeah, what I'll say is, not to diminish whatever problems he's having, but frankly, I'm kind of bored of the whole drugs and over-touring leads to a fracture among the band story. It's been told so many times, you know, Van Halen, Green Day, and I'm sure lots of other times. But I'm you guys know this story that the Rolling Stones sort of told that story, the Kinks told that story, the Who told that story. Pretty much every big band has told that story. Metallica told that story, and frankly, I'm bored of it. It's like, you know what? There's people with real problems in the world, so I really don't care if you can't say no to your dealer so much. I mean, I hope he gets over whatever problems he's having, but it's not something that I find particularly interesting, and it's not as – I'm going to sound cold when I say this, but it's not something that I have a whole lot of sympathy for. I've got some sympathy for him, but I mean, there's people that got a lot worse than Billy Joe, so, you know, just kind of, you know, work through it, boys, and maybe focus on putting out some good music. What I will say is I was never a Green Day fan to begin with, but I understand their importance. I understand how they were important to a lot of people. I kind of think this is the beginning of the Green Day's end, where they end with like a whimper instead of a bang. I think that's what's happening, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? You release 3 records and it doesn't really make any huge wave. That's a whole bunch of mediocre bedrock that you've just built the next stage of your career on top of. Like, you know, it's easy to live down, you know, one flop, but you know, after you go all out on this, I don't know, if you ask me, rather misguided release schedule that they did for these things, and no one really cares. Well, you know, how do you build the excitement for the next thing? It was too much. Too quickly, and it was probably too much stuff that could have been cut and weaned down. And I don't know. I feel like they blew any chance they had to actually build some serious excitement about it. I mean, after, you know, if you got Uno and Dos, and neither of those really were amazing, how excited are you when Trey comes out?
Yeah.
And how excited are you when the next thing that's going to come out comes out? So, you know, I got to imagine that this whole release schedule thing made some poor publicist at Reprise there just pull their hair out. So,
you know, Fat Mike called, the people make fun of him a lot, and I don't necessarily agree with a lot of things Fat Mike has to say, but as a businessman, he's pretty wise. He said, it's stupid to put out 3 records that quickly in a row tied together, because what if everybody hates the first record? And you know what? I mean, not everybody hated the first record. But I think people that say they love the first record are really just Green Day mega fans that'll like it no matter what, and they don't even really like it. And that's exactly what happened. The first had the best sales, second and third had worse and worse sales. And, you know, too much filler, basically. So
yeah.
So anyways, sorry to end on a down note, but things are pretty popping here at the Punk News Podcast Spring Break Summer Blowout 2013. I think we're going to keep the jams going. We've got a jam by a band called The Garden. One of our VJs is going to introduce it. This is a new VJ on the Punk News Podcast. He's called the Track Keeper. I've never heard of him before, but the Track Keeper is going to introduce the next song. Track Keeper, take it away. Well, hello there, punk ghouls. This is your neighborhood deadly track keeper, and I'm here to bring you a frighteningly good track from The Garden. The Garden is a new band that is just a pair of twins playing haunting, creepy, and spine-tingling strange music. One on drums and one on bass. Now that's what I call a deadly duo. They have a new cassette out on Burger Records called Everything is Perfect. You could say that the cassette is a dead format, but at $6, the price is fright. This track is called Express Sector 28. I think it's going to be a real shock and roll sadomasoch. I hope you enjoy it, but in the meantime, don't mind me. I'll just be hanging around. Spring Blank Blah 2013. Do you guys have a good time?
I have sand everywhere.
Yes, he does. Woo! Confirmed.
Woo! All right, well, I want to say thanks to all the bands that contributed. Thanks to Yancey.
You're welcome, as always.
Thanks to the band that you played.
Congenital Death.
Adam White, thanks to you. Thanks for uses of your spiritual wheelhouse, which we all enjoyed very much and plan on using our own spiritual wheelhouses in the future. Thanks to The Garden, and as always, the opinion expressed on the Punk News Podcast are the opinion of the people speaking them themselves. They do not in any way reflect the opinions or idea of punknews.org or anybody affiliated with punknews.org. Thanks again for hanging out with us at the Spring Break Summer Blowout 2013, and we'll see you guys next week.
Woo!
Woo!